The Simpsons, Saturday Night Live, The Daily Show, the animation of Terry Gilliam, The Onion, retrace the strands that led to a lot of current American satire, and sooner or later you end up at Harvey Kurtzman. He was the founding editor of Mad Magazine. Dennis Kitchen has collected Harvey Kurtzman's original art and tells Kurtzman's story in a new coffee table-sized book. Kitchen had a lot of material to work with. Kurtzman was not only an editor, he was also an artist and a writer. Late in his career, he stayed clear of the poorhouse with a Playboy comic strip, and we emphasize the word strip. It was called Little Annie Fanny. But before that, and more memorably than that, there was Mad, first published in 1952.
He created it as a concept. He was the writer of every story. He drew most of the early covers himself. He laid out every story so that the artists, like it or not, had to follow his formula and his precise composition of every page. So he was, in a sense, a one-man band, but he was also aided by some of the very top cartoonists, not only of their day, but probably of the century. And its influence is profound on the mass culture.
Yeah, to measure that influence, we should say Mad Magazine is credited with the idea of satirizing other things in the mass media of the day.
Right. That was virtually unknown before he really plowed that field. And he also satirized politics. He was there attacking Joe McCarthy early on. But mainly it was, a satire of other media, in other words, other comic books themselves, but also the mass culture in terms of advertising. As one critic put it back then, it was a machine gun attack on American culture.
Yeah, my introduction to the work of Harvey Kurtzman, we're talking about 50 years ago now, was in his comic book Super Duper Man.
Yeah, that's a perfect example of taking on probably the most iconic of all cartoon characters.
Yeah. Now, something happens in Super Duper Man, which is that the mild-mannered, everyday disguise of the superhero runs into a phone booth to change, and much screaming comes out of the phone booth, and he says, "Drat, fool, phone booth is occupied," and there's a woman sitting in the phone booth who wanted to change there.
Exactly.
These Mad cartoons were considered a bit risque for the time, and in fact, as you write in the book, there had been congressional hearings in, was it 54, denouncing
yes.
comic books.
Yeah, Senator Kefauver tried to convince the public that comic books could rot the minds of juveniles and, in fact, lead to juvenile delinquency.
The hearings actually put a damper on Mad Magazine. It was hard for newsstands to sell it.
You know, comic books were the cheapest periodical on the racks, thus the least profitable. So all it took was a little controversy, and newsstands and certainly newsstand distributors wanted to distance themselves. So it was a very rough time, and that's when Harvey convinced his publisher to turn Mad the comic book into Mad the magazine.
And he did it for a couple of years.
About 3 years. And then he made the first of what can be seen as a series of bad business decisions, or you could just say bad luck. He left Mad as it was peaking. And remember, this is a magazine that at its height sold 2 to 3 million copies per month.
Yeah, to make a long story short, Harvey Kurtzman, immensely gifted as an artist, gifted as a writer, as a satirical writer, gifted as a businessman, not at all.
Unfortunately not. In fact, one of his good friends, a colleague, Will Eisner, who's also one of the giants in the comics field, Will Eisner was not only a great cartoonist, but a great businessman. And as Harvey's wife, Adele, has recounted, Harvey always went to Will for advice, but never took it.
Well, Dennis Kitchen, author of the book The Art of Harvey Kurtzman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Robert.
And to see a gallery of Harvey Kurtzman's illustrations, you can go to our website, npr.org.
Imagine the sight of a foreign nemesis barnstorming across America, kissing babies, being greeted by crowds, the press following every move, all while the pugnacious world leader criticizes the American way of life and hurls one-liners at local leaders. You don't have to imagine it. It all happened. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the unusual visit to the United States by the then General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. Nikita Khrushchev took every opportunity to tell his side of things to anyone who would listen. For example, this moment from his road trip where he explained what he really meant when he said to America, "We will bury you."
When I spoke of the burial, that should not be understood literally, word for word, as if someone was going to take a spade and start burying somebody.
The trip is the subject of a new book, K Blows Top, a Cold War comic interlude starring Nikita Khrushchev, America's unlikely tourist. Peter Carlson, a former columnist from The Washington Post, is the author of K Blows Top, and he joins us in studio. Hi, Peter.
Hello.
So K Blows Top is one of the real headlines from his trip. First of all, tell us what he blew his top about and why we only called him K in headlines.
They called him K because Khrushchev is a very long name, and it couldn't fit in headlines. So the headline from which I took the story was in the New York Daily News after Khrushchev blew his top because he wasn't allowed to go to Disneyland. The headline was three lines, denied tour of Disneyland, K blows top. One of my favorites came out before Khrushchev arrived, Khrushchev to get free dry cleaning. And another one of my favorites, above a story of a man who went crazy and killed two people after he watched Khrushchev's arrival on television. The headline was, sees K on TV, so he murders two.
And they're all real headlines, and they're all real things that happened.
I couldn't make it up.
Let's talk about the origin of the visit. The head Cold Warrior of the time, the Soviet leader setting foot on U.S. soil. Actually, it was a bit of a diplomatic snafu. He wasn't really just invited to come around and stomp around the United States. What happened?
Well, Khrushchev had threatened to do something unspecified bad to West Berlin. And the Soviets and the Americans and British and French were negotiating about Berlin in Geneva. President Eisenhower, in the hopes of getting an agreement in Geneva, decided to invite Khrushchev to the United States, and he wrote a letter to Khrushchev. And the letter was given to one of Khrushchev's aides by a State Department official named Robert Murphy. And Murphy was supposed to tell the aide that the invitation had a condition to it, and the condition was if they came to an agreement in Geneva, then Khrushchev was invited to the United States. But Murphy forgot to say that. Khrushchev got the letter and immediately said, sure, I'll come over. How about letting me travel around the country for a couple of weeks? Wasn't much Ike could do. He couldn't uninvite him.
He was quite angry about it, though, Eisenhower.
He was very angry, and he gave Murphy quite the tongue-lashing.
How was the itinerary set?
Well, there was a lot of fighting about that. Thousands of Americans had written saying, please come to my house, my lodge meeting, my town, my factory. Finally, basically, they let Khrushchev go where he wanted to go, which was Washington, New York, Hollywood, San Francisco, and a steel mill in Pittsburgh. And from there to summit talks with Ike at Camp David.
Did any diplomatic work get done? Because every time the United States diplomats or Henry Cabot Lodge, who was sort of his keeper, showed him something that was wonderfully American, Khrushchev would just say, we have it better in the Soviet Union, or that's not so great.
That's right, except for hot dogs. He really liked our hot dogs. Also, he liked the lockers at Union Station in Washington. In the Soviet Union, you checked your coat or your bags while you were waiting for a train and you had to stand on line. And Khrushchev was fascinated by the lockers in the stadium where you could put your stuff in and you could put a quarter in and take the key out.
You write a lot about how he was just followed by throngs of reporters. And do you think this trip had a lasting effect on media coverage?
I think it did. Scotty Reston, a columnist of the New York Times, wrote a column about how Khrushchev and Lodge and all the other people were not really talking to each other, but were talking to the media. And Khrushchev himself instinctively understood this, and he knew that his trip was less a diplomatic tour than it was a big TV show starring himself as the new charismatic leader of this young and vibrant communist world, as he saw it at the time.
One of the members of the media during all of this was Daniel Schorr, who, of course, we all know from NPR, but he was a CBS correspondent at the time, right?
Yes, he had been in Russia. He spoke fluent Russian, and I believe he had been kicked out a couple years earlier, and he covered 59 tour, and then again when Khrushchev came back in 1960.
So, Peter, I'd like you to read a passage from the book in which Dan Shore makes an appearance. And we've actually asked Dan Shore to play the role of Dan Shore.
Khrushchev is on a train from L.A. They've stopped at a whistle stop, and he got out and met people. And so he's now in a great mood because he believes that the American people love him. So in the train, he walks into the car full of reporters, and this is what happens. He didn't need strong liquids. He was already high. "Today I won my freedom," he announced. "I was able to meet real live Americans and look them in the eye. I'm happy that the house arrest I was placed under has been lifted."
"You seem in better humor today than you did last night in Los Angeles,"
Daniel Shore said. "You know, Mr. Shore, when they stick pins in you, you have to retaliate," Khrushchev replied. He illustrated by throwing a quick punch toward Shore's gut, causing the CBS correspondent to flinch and step backwards.
"Does this mean that you've decided not to go home?"
"Why should I go?" Khrushchev asked. "Did you see the crowd at the railroad station? Did you see that little girl waving at me? She was waving at communism."
Did Khrushchev enjoy this back and forth with reporters?
Oh, he loved that. He was very good at banter, and he loved it, and they loved to do it.
Yet he took great offense when it was suggested that Pravda and the like did not have freedom of the press.
That's true. He did not like to be criticized by people, and he would always defend his press and say, "It's really none of your business." Ironically, when he was old, he'd been overthrown. He grumbled to his friends that he was reading Pravda, and he couldn't believe they would print this crap because no one would possibly believe it.
The book does not end with Khrushchev just going home and saying goodbye to America. You actually talk about one of the most famous incidents involving Khrushchev, the shoe incident, where he banged his shoe on the desk at the UN because he was angry that the Soviet Union was criticized for aggression towards Eastern Europe. But after reading your book, I wonder if that shoe-banging incident isn't related in some way to the 10-day trip, because it seemed that Khrushchev and Eisenhower had bonded in some way.
Yes, he felt that he had gotten along very well with Eisenhower. He flew home, immediately went to a huge rally in Moscow, and he praised Eisenhower's wisdom and Eisenhower's love of peace. And it wasn't just rhetoric, because he went back and he cut the military budget by a lot. He reduced his military by over 1 million men. And he built a golf course so that when Ike came to the Soviet Union the following spring, he would be able to play his favorite game. But then Ike sent a U-2 plane spying over Russia on May 1st, 1960. And the Soviets shot it down. And Khrushchev looked to the hardliners at the Kremlin like a weakling because his friend Eisenhower had betrayed him. So Khrushchev threw a major temper tantrum and canceled Ike's trip to the Soviet Union. He appointed himself head of the Soviets' delegation to the UN and acted terribly. He did everything he could to embarrass Eisenhower and denounce the United States.
Peter Carlson, a former columnist from The Washington Post, is the author of K Blows Top. Thanks for being with us, Peter.
Thank you.
You can read an excerpt of K Blows Top on our website, npr.org. If you are one of the 50 million Americans who are believed to do crossword puzzles on a regular basis, you have a fellow traveler in Dean Olscher. Dean used to cover arts and culture for NPR. Now he's written a book about crosswords titled From Square One. He calls it a collection of dispatches from puzzle land. Dean writes about what drives so many of us to fill in that black and white grid, how crosswords affect our brain or don't. Here's Dean Olscher reading from his book about the allure of what he calls his magnificent obsession.
For those native to the world of the puzzle, entering a crossword is like stepping into the clean white cube of an art gallery or into a church or a Japanese rock garden. There are days when solving puzzles feels like a practice, the next best thing to seated meditation. When beautifully executed, a crossword can bring about the same response as a work of art. It is more honest, though, to think of crosswords as a habit, like smoking. It's just something to do every day because it's there.
And Dean, there are real tensions there in what you're saying. You're saying part of this is like sort of zen, but part of it is pure addiction.
Yes, that is my ambivalence about crosswords, and that's what fueled my writing of this book. You know, crosswords can be attractive because we think that they are helpful when it comes to mental health in all kinds of ways. But then the flip side of that is maybe just the opposite. Maybe crosswords are not only not going to keep us from getting Alzheimer's, it's not a kind of meditative practice, but in fact maybe its own form of mental illness.
And we'll talk about that because you try to debunk this notion, which is propagated pretty widely, that if you do crossword puzzles, it can help your mental state. Maybe it'll help stave off Alzheimer's or dementia. You're not so sure about that.
No, not at all. I actually interviewed one of the first researchers in the Bronx at Albert Einstein who did the study that was very widely reported on. He was looking into leisure activities and the relationship to losing your mind. And, you know, he said, first of all, crosswords were only marginally related. Second of all, he never said that there was a cause and effect relationship. He said there is some correlation. Maybe it just so happens that people who are mentally fit have a tendency to want to do crossword puzzles.
In the first place.
In the first place, right.
They're predisposed.
But, you know, what we're learning is that it really has a lot more to do with physical activity than it does with mental activity. And that'll be the thing that probably, I think we're going to find out, is most important.
You know, this question of whether crossword puzzles help our brain fits into this sort of running dialogue you have through the book with none other than Weekend Edition's puzzle master, Will Shortz. This is one of many points, it seems, on which you disagree with Will.
He has taken advantage of the marketing opportunity, which is to be expected. You know, and so there's a whole series of books about how puzzles will keep your brain sharp and everything like that. He and I are on different sides of this, and that's okay. I think we've agreed to disagree.
Do you remember, Dean, when the first time was that you did a crossword puzzle, when you got hooked?
I do not remember a time before crosswords. I did them with my mother. She introduced me to the New York Times crossword puzzle. And I do have a very early memory when she and I were working on a puzzle. And there was an example of misdirection, you know, a clue that is making you think one way, but in fact it's another. And she said, "What an amazing language." And I found that, I mean, it's something I've thought of my whole life because I was thinking, gosh, is it true that the English language is more amazing than others?
It's interesting to think about those memories. I mean, I have a very distinct memory of sitting with my dad and watching him and learning how to do the diagramless puzzle with, you know, a piece of graph paper and pencils with big erasers on them.
Yeah.
And that just sticks with you. I mean, I think once you get it, you're stuck.
And I think this is a sort of an oral tradition in America. People pass down puzzles through the generations and have connections to their own mother or grandmother doing the puzzle and finding that sort of connection with another person in the family first.
You spend a lot of time in the book trying to wrestle with the question of why we do crosswords. What's appealing about them? What did you decide in the end?
I do think that there is this addictive property, and that's a theme in the book. There is also a quality about them that is immersive, and that's what we like about symphony orchestras, cinema. When you go into a grand movie palace with a large screen and you get sucked into the movie, I think something similar happens with crossword puzzles. We like to be sucked into something that's bigger than ourselves and makes us feel as if we've entered into this other world. It's a world that happens entirely inside our brain. And so that was the tricky part, was to try to get at this extremely interior experience.
You know, there is this other side to it, I think. I mean, I'm speaking as a lifelong crossword puzzle doer, crossword puzzler. I'm not sure what the word is. Somebody who created crossword puzzles in her high school newsletter.
You did?
I share a studio with Robert Siegel, who regularly does the London Times cryptic puzzle. So
yes,
You're among friends here. But isn't there something pretty basic about it, which is just that it makes you feel clever?
But here's the other thing. Have you noticed you do the New York Times puzzle? There's a set of references, right, that you're familiar with.
There's a sort of language of crosswords, yeah.
Right. But if you step out of your own dialect and try a puzzle made by some other syndicator, edited by somebody else, don't you find that it's alien territory?
Well, I never do those puzzles.
Yeah, exactly, right. Because they reinforce the same set of associations, which is one of the reasons why I dispute the idea that crosswords will keep you from getting Alzheimer's. Because the fact is, it is kind of the same activity over and over again. And the Alzheimer's research is showing really what matters is novelty. So maybe if you've never done crosswords, you do that for a while, but then you switch to learning a new language or taking up a musical instrument. Constantly exposing yourself to something new, that is much more likely, I think, to keep you sharp in the long run.
Dean Olscher's book is titled From Square One, A Meditation with Digressions on Crosswords. Dean, great to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You can read an excerpt of From Square One at npr.org. And Robert,
you give me too much credit.
Well, you would be pleased to know that Dean Olscher is on a campaign, a crusade maybe you could say, to get more Americans hooked on the cryptic puzzle, which you love so much.
From the Times. And they can look at clues like this one today. Regularly indulge in not working. Four letters.
Idle, lays.
Idle, because idle occurs regularly every other letter in indulge, you see.
I'm going to have to think about that one for a while. It's gonna... I love the cryptic rubber, but I have to say
It's not just the what, it's the how of it.
And it's all a code that you have to figure out just by looking at the clues. The clues are complicated in themselves.
Yeah.
Okay. Dean, Robert, you got to hook people on the cryptics.
Okay.